Okay, so Charlie Chaplin was the first international film star. Before there were movie stars, Charlie Chaplin was the one to come along, him and a group of people who were the first. He's generally remembered for a character which is now known as the Little Tramp, which is he wore a little bowler hat, a cane, and a little tattered suit, and a little toothbrush mustache. And he made a series of brilliant films, and he started with short films, and eventually got longer features to up to 2 hours. And it's all of his films were really full of, they were funny, they were full of heart, they were brilliant in a whole number of ways. And as the Tramp, he played basically a homeless vagrant who spent his time stealing food from babies, running from the police, and falling in and out of, you know, a series of unrequited romances. Some of his best films are with this character, the Tramp. The Kid, The Gold Rush, Circus, and City Lights. Any of those, rent them, they're brilliant. But for the most part, they're not explicitly political. However, after City Lights, he made a series of films in the 30s and 40s that were more political. And Chaplin himself was a radical from early on. But at the same time, his politics were bound up with the contradictory politics of the American left, specifically the American Communist Party. So there's a lot to criticize Chaplin for politically. More or less unconditional support for the Soviet Union, support for the Democratic Party and U.S. policy during World War II, among other things. So Chaplin was a deeply flawed individual. He was a notorious womanizer and had a number of affairs. You know, probably the first famous movie star to have affairs, a whole series of women, including women who are really, really too young. Nonetheless, his legacy is very important and worth remembering for a number of reasons. I'm not going to go into that. But I mean, you could go into that and have a whole separate talk about that. And I'll just say it's unsavory to say the least. But I think there are reasons why Chaplin's legacy is important. Three reasons in particular. First, he was a radical. Genuinely, he criticized capitalism and war. He spoke out against McCarthyism, and was—that's the second part, which is he was a victim of McCarthyism. He was eventually forced out of the country by reactionary forces. And third, he was a brilliant filmmaker, both of apolitical films and of very, very political films. Now, there's plenty more things to say about a whole series. You know, you can have a whole series of talks about this guy's long, productive lifetime. But I'm really going to focus over these issues. Unfortunately, I have to skip over a lot of things. Now, he started with very humble beginnings. He grew up in the East End of London. His father was alcoholic and absentee. His mother was mentally ill, was probably a prostitute for some time in her life. That meant he was in and out of state care and the workhouse and really lived the poverty of Victorian England. He had very little education. He could, even as late as 13, he could barely read. And as a young child, with his mother's active support, he was became a comedic performer. And in his early 20s, he ended up touring the U.S. On the vaudeville stage, and was discovered by the filmmaker Max Sennett in 1914. Very quickly, his second film with Max Sennett was The Little Tramp, and that was pretty much the character he played for the rest of his life. Very quickly, also after he was discovered, World War I occurred. And he was probably a radical at the time, it's not really clear, but he definitely wasn't expressing it. And in fact, he was worried about criticism that he hadn't applied for the draft, hadn't joined the British Army or the American Army. And because of that criticism, he made a couple of films that were basically pro-war. You know, they weren't sort of bloodthirsty, racist, you know, kind of warmongering movies, but they were in fact pro-war, encouraging people to buy Liberty Bonds for the war. Even bought a bunch himself to make a point. But after the war, something changed. And probably his own confidence more than anything else. Maybe it was the atmosphere in the country. But he began expressing some of his ideas in a European tour in 1918. And again, his rise was overnight. In 2 years, he was nobody. 2 years later, 1916, he's the biggest movie star in the world. In 1918, after the war, he goes on a European tour. And again, he was mobbed by thousands of people. First time this ever happened to anybody. Journalists would ask him, a number of questions about his travels. This was within a year after the Russian Revolution. They would ask him, "Are you a Bolshevik?" And his response was, I am an artist. I am interested in life. Bolshevism is a new phase of life. I must be interested in it. And when he was pressed, he would say, well, I'm an artist, not a politician. But it's pretty clear where his sympathies lie, and said, you know, he wanted to meet Lenin and Trotsky and some of the people. But through this period, for, you know, really 20 years, he made brilliant films. Sometimes had themes like, again, poverty, you know, the tramps, poverty, identifying with immigrants or with single mothers, or, you know, a whole series, you know, always identified with downtrodden, but it wasn't specifically about a message or about a problem in society. So I'm going to show a quick clip from The Circus, which is a film he made in the 1920s. What this is about is he's joined the circus. The tramp has joined the circus, and he's competing for the love of a trapeze artist, competing with a taller and more handsome tightrope walker. This just gives you an idea of what some of his films are like. And this petty jealousy, and these are things that he comes back to often. Now, again, skipping over this entire brilliant career to the 1930s, when he started making political films, was during the Great Depression. Millions of people were out of work in the 1930s. The American economy shrunk, but also people started fighting back. By 1934, there were mass strikes in San Francisco, Toledo, and Minneapolis, where workers were violently defending their picket lines against police attacking them. And Chaplin really, you know, especially with his background, he really couldn't help but be affected by this, but also feel some confidence in the need to really speak out about it. In the early 30s, he meets Albert Einstein, and who's also a socialist, and they have a discussion between themselves about economic problems and social welfare. Einstein was really impressed with him. He says, "You're not a comedian, you're an economist." And Chaplin later took this line. He says, I am reputedly a comedian, but after seeing the financial conditions of the world, I have decided I'm as much an economist as financiers are comedians. So Modern Times is the film that he made that really started this trend with him. This came out in 1936, so between the mass labor upsurges of 1934 and the sit-down strikes, 37. The little tramp plays an overworked factory worker whose boss, you know, he's sitting there slaving over the line. His boss is sitting in an air-conditioned office reading the funny pages, telling him to go faster and faster. Here's a couple clips from Modern Times. Thank you. Workers under industrial capitalism, the police battling striking workers. And there's another thing that comes up in the film is really the impossibility of the American dream. He goes from job to job, and they find this horrible house they move into, and it's just a whole series of just disastrous employment opportunities, and he ends up being unemployed, and, you know, it's a disaster. I think the thing you could criticize about the film politically is it's really not about fighting back. And there's a couple scenes like this, which, I mean, it's a hilarious scene, but there's no sense of, this sort of struggle is all sort of accidental, and sometimes he's kind of, you know, annoyed by it, and he gets a job, and there's a strike, and he's like, oh, I just finally got this job, and, you know, so it's not especially about, the rebellion aspect, but it's pretty clear whose side he's on. He's taken the side of the working class and the downtrodden. Now, this changes more in a later movie. I'll get to that. But the other aspect also is you know, again, at the time, the Great Depression wasn't just great poverty, but it was also great rebellion. One of the key leading forces was the Communist Party at the time. They grew from 7,000 in 1929 to 80,000 by the end of the 30s. Their politics were based on support for the Russian Revolution, but also distorted by Stalinism. And by the mid-1930s, their main strategy was called the Popular Front, which was very successful in a number of economic struggles, fighting racism and opposing fascism, but it also meant supporting the Democratic Party, supporting liberalism uncritically, and of course supporting Stalin uncritically, and that created a number of problems. Chaplin was definitely never a member. He may or may not have been close to becoming a member at some point. There's a number of famous people in the 30s who, you know, could have been, and sometimes the Communist Party said, you know, don't join, but sort of be a public supporter. He was probably in that milieu. But his politics were definitely shaped by the Communist Party. He supported FDR in the New Deal, but he was also a very active supporter of Upton Sinclair's campaign, who ran as a Democrat for governor of California, but also as a critic of the New Deal. His program was called EPIC, End Poverty in California, and it called for the nationalization of the film industry. Now, the film industry, the movie moguls, were furious about this. They made propaganda movies of, you know, homeless people getting on trains, coming to California to take our jobs and to take the social welfare that Sinclair was promising them. And it was this kind of campaign that helped defeat Sinclair. But Chaplin was, even though he was himself, owned his own studio and was very wealthy, he and actually a number of film workers in Hollywood at the time, the Sinclair campaign really helped grow a Hollywood left. One of the things about on the Hollywood left that's key is the what became known as the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League between 1936 and 1939. The Hollywood Anti-Nazi League was formed of, you know, famous actors, but also other film workers who rallied against fascism in Germany and Italy, and especially in Spain, where fascism was in the balance. The leaders included the writer Dorothy Parker, the actor Frederick March, and the German director Fritz Lang, who at that time had moved to Hollywood, escaping Hitler and had become an actor in Hollywood. The largest meeting the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League had in L.A. was had up to 10,000 people, but the regular membership of the group was 4,000 to 5,000 people. And Chaplin was a known supporter and attended the meetings and an advocate. But he himself, obviously was disgusted by the rise of fascism and Hitler. He also had a bit of a personal stake. The Nazis hated Chaplin. One of the Nazi publications called Chaplin, quote, "A little Jewish acrobat, as disgusting as he is tedious." Now, he actually wasn't Jewish. And you know, I until I started researching this, I never knew that. I assumed he was, mostly because of the Great Dictator. I'll get to that. But his films were banned once Hitler came to power because they hated him so much, both because of his radicalism and because of his Judaism. he also, Chaplin must have been furious about Hitler stealing his look, right? It really was his look. He had been around, but no one knew who Hitler was until well later. And he took advantage of this in The Great Dictator to really just humiliate Adolf Hitler. He played a character called Adenoid Hinkle, who was the fooey of a country called Tomania. He was a Hitler-like dictator. He was a brutal dictator, but he's also a childish little idiot. But he also played the little tramp in a separate character, who was a Jewish barber who ends up getting confused with the Hinkle. Now it's a hilarious movie, but it's also pretty devastating about how it portrays the Nazi regime. It portrays pogroms against Jews in the Jewish ghettos. The stormtroopers come and they paint Jew on people. This is 1940. Remember, they paint Jew on people's windows. They try to lynch Chaplin, and they almost do it. Hinkle specifically talks about eliminating the entire Jewish race. This is at a time in 1940. It was released in 1940 before the U.S. had actually declared war on Germany, when they still had diplomatic relations. But it was started made in 1938, before the war even officially broken out. There was a strong isolationist right-wing current within the U.S. that was openly anti-Semitic. And expressed by many leading figures. Some Henry Ford, for example, was fairly openly anti-Semitic and did business with the Nazi regime. Maybe not all of the Hollywood studio owners were Jews themselves, because of the economics of the film industry coming, starting up in these little ethnic neighborhoods by people with shop corners, and these guys eventually become studio owners. Almost all of them were Jewish. And obviously had very little sympathy, no sympathy at all for Hitler. But they were also businessmen, and they were very concerned about, they wanted to avoid controversial statements, they also didn't want to lose business to Germany and Italy. And so they were really reluctant to do anything in public. Like I said, many people thought Chaplin was a Jew. Part of the reason why people still don't, assume he is, besides the Great Dictators, he usually refused to deny it, and he didn't want to feed into anti-Semitism and be like, and so he would just, refuse to deny it. And sometimes when he did, he would say, people say, "Are you a Jew?" And he says, "That is an honor I do not have." And he really wanted to show, which side he was on. Now the Great Dictator is, actually, let me go ahead and show a clip.
Die Welt stürzt sich das Helden sagt. Und die Arien.
Be careful.
Und die Arien Maiden. Die Arien Maiden. Die Delikatesse mit der Schö. Mit der Stress. Und der Ulstein mit der Muss. Der Muss. Von der Kinder Katzenjammer. Der Katzenjammer mit der guten Sekt. Der Hinten, Weiten, Wutten, Weiten, Dotten, guten Sekt. Hey, Soldiers for Hinkle! Der Juden. Und der Stift, der Sauerkraut mit der Juden. Und der Leberwurst mit der Juden. Der Blitzensekteiger mit der Juden. Der Blutensekteierten. Und der Strangelchen mit der Blutensekteierten. Und der Blitzensekteigen. Besick, besack. Der Juden. His Excellency has just referred to the Jewish people.
We've just discovered the most wonderful, the most marvelous poison gas. It will kill everybody.
All right, later, later, later.
The men are planning a strike at the arms factory.
Who's the leader?
There were five of them.
Have been shot.
They were, Your Excellency.
Oh. How many do you say were going on strike?
The whole factory. 3,000 of them.
Have them all shot. I don't want any of my workers dissatisfied. Strange. Brunettes. What a blonde amongst them.
Brunettes are troublemakers. They're worse than the Jews.
Then wipe them out.
Too small. Not so fast. We get rid of the Jews first, then concentrate on the brunettes.
We shall never have peace until we have a pure Aryan race. How wonderful. Tomania, a nation of blue-eyed blondes.
Why not a blonde Europe, a blonde Asia, a blonde America?
Blonde world.
And a brunette dictator.
Dictator of the world.
Why not? Not Caesar, Art Nullus. The world is effete, worn out, afraid. No nation would dare to oppose you.
Interest in modern times, and she appeared in this movie too. This time, she plays an angry Jewish woman who Chaplin's character, the little tramp, ends up falling in love with. And she's one of the people who's the most despised Hinkle, and really expresses an open desire to rise up against him and to rebel against him. She eventually helps to organize a suicide mission to help assassinate Hinkle, and Chaplin is the little tramp. Ends up sort of getting sucked into that. He, you know, goes on the mission, and gets caught. They end up in a concentration camp. And, I mean, you know, it really gives you a sense of how much there's just open disgust with this regime, and how much, you know, they really felt angry about it. But the one thing, and it just is a little too long to show, and there's a final scene in The Great Dictator where the little tramp gets mistaken for Hinkle, and stands up and he gives this big speech on the radio and to a mass audience. And it's really a 6-minute tirade against fascism and capitalism and imperialism. And it's heavily criticized at the time by critics and still. A couple things he says, because it's so sort of overtly kind of speechy and preachy. But he talks about, he talks against greed. He says, you know, machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. He says, you the people have the power, then in the name of democracy, let us use this power, let us all unite. Let's fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do with greed, do with hate and intolerance. And it goes on and on. Now, critics at the time, and still, one critic called it horribly botched. The London Times critic said, the finale is so out of harmony with what has gone before as to nullify much of the effectiveness of the preceding 2 hours. And that's just over the top. I mean, sure, it could have been shorter. Sure, it was a little sort of, phrase-mongering kind of thing. But it really is an impassioned speech, and it isn't just sort of an angry tirade. He eventually kind of realizes he's getting too angry, and he speaks from his heart, and he's just, you know, and it's a very ambiguous ending, but it's also very hopeful. You know, it's much more subtle a moment than he's usually given credit for, especially for movies that have come since that have just ended on these, commentary from the filmmakers. It really is a heartfelt moment that's worth seeing, but I don't have time. People should go home and watch the movie. Now, The Great Dictator was one of his biggest hits. It was one of the biggest movies of the year. It was nominated for the Oscar for the Best Picture. He instructed the distributor, United Artists, to pay the European sales of the movie to a Viennese Jewish group helping refugees from Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, war had broken out by the time in Europe. So, you know, it wasn't just played at the time. So, but he, you know, found other money of himself and got other donors to donate money to Jewish refugees. But after the war, it played in Italy and Germany to just absolutely stunned audiences for what they see after the fall of the fascist regime. Now, it should be, may not be obvious, it should be fairly obvious that Chaplin eventually was a supporter of World War II. And this really shows the full contradictions of his politics, Stalin's politics at the time. One of the things he was most advocate for was the campaign for a second front, which a number of especially Hollywood leftists were involved in, arguing for a Western front against Hitler, basically to ease the Eastern front of the Soviet Union. He spoke to an audience of 3,000 people in Carnegie Hall advocating a second front. And this is how he started his comments. "Dear comrades, yes, I mean comrades, when one sees the magnificent fight the Russian people are putting up, it is a pleasure and a privilege to use the word comrade. He'd say he's unconcerned about reports that communism might spread around the world, quote, because I can live on $25,000 a year. And he was a fabulously wealthy person. And later he would say, you know, communism happens to be what the Russians are fighting for, and the way they are fighting, they must like it pretty well. I'm not a communist, but I feel pretty pro-communist. And you can see wrapped up in there is a sense of sort of struggle and liberation and, you know, but also just a complete identifying socialism and Soviet Union and that's exactly precisely the same thing. But there were also problems with supporting World War II itself. I can't go into it, obviously, but, you know, the U.S. Was not interested in didn't show a lot of interest in saving Jews or stopping fascism. In fact, you know, cooperated with fascist regimes, especially Spain, through and after the war. Many industrialists supported Hitler and did business in Germany, like Ford and IBM, for example. And Jews seeking asylum in the U.S. were turned away. Domestically, the war meant, you know, taking away of civil liberties, internment of the Japanese, you know, strike pledge led by the Communist Party, a segregated army, you know, a whole number of problems. And the war ended with the dropping of the atomic bomb in Japan. Now, Chaplin had really nothing to say about these things, and it's unfortunate. The Communist Party didn't have nothing to say. They supported them. They were actively on the wrong side. And it really shows the, you know, kind of the mess of Stalinist politics that Chaplin had gotten himself into. Now, you would think this would be patriotic, but after the war, you know, it was not seen as patriotic at all to have supported a second front. And in fact, people like Chaplin who spoke out about this were and who were active in the radical milieu in Hollywood were attacked under McCarthyism. Liberals at the time saw World War II as a victory for democracy in the U.S. over fascism, and that enlightened capitalism was a bulwark against Soviet tyranny, and really had begun a real rift had been growing between liberals and Stalinists. And made many of them timid against McCarthyism. The Hollywood left in particular was under attack by McCarthyism, partly because it was such a symbol they could use to show the whole country. But it wasn't just that innocent liberals were smeared with accusations. That's true. That's an aspect of it, that people were sort of caught up in things and accused of things they hadn't done. It was also the case that there were, by one measure, 300 members of the Communist Party working as film workers in Hollywood. By the late 40s. About half of them were screenwriters. Screenwriters were among the most active members of the Communist Party. Eventually, hundreds of these people, both members and supporters, and even people who weren't supporters but didn't want to finger their friends, were blacklisted because they refused to name names and they refused to cooperate. On the other hand, if you didn't want to be blacklisted, it meant naming names of other members of the party. It meant apologizing for your past activity, whatever it was. It meant groveling. It meant praising HUAC, the House of American Activities Committee. It wasn't just enough to name names. You had to really legitimize the whole project of McCarthyism. Now, in the first attack against the Hollywood left, dozens of people in Hollywood were subpoenaed to testify, and Chaplin was one among these people. He wrote a letter to the House Un-American Activities Committee once he was subpoenaed. It says, quote, "In order that you may be completely up to date on my thinking, I suggest that you view carefully my latest production, Monsieur Godot. It is against war and the futile slaughter of our youth. I trust that you will find its humane message distasteful. But while you are preparing your engraved subpoena, I will give you a hint of where I stand. I am not a communist. I am a peacemonger." He sent this telegram to every member of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and I'll get to this movie in a second to see how inflammatory this was. he was never called just to testify. Eventually, 10 people were called who were unfriendly witnesses. They were blacklisted, and then the big blacklist came several years later after their court appeals went on down. But they actually never testified. He never asked to testify, none of that stuff, partly because of his belligerent response, but really more because he had an independence that other people, you know, he owned his own studio, he owned his own distributor, he was an enormous star, and he wasn't going to back down. So they were like, well, let's just forget about him, and sort of the problem will go away. And they also attacked him in other ways. But the point is, blacklisting was meaningless. You couldn't have blacklisted Chaplin at the time, not just because of his popularity. But he continued to speak out. He put his name in support of the Hollywood Ten. He had a number of friends who were blacklisted and who called to testify and supported them, fundraised for them, and was actively involved in their campaigns. Now, this movie that that came out precisely at the time as the Hollywood Ten trial started, the beginning of the McCarthyite attack on Hollywood, was Monsieur Verdoux, which is Chaplin plays a French bank teller who loses his job in the 30s. He ends up marrying and then killing a whole series of women so they can steal their money and support his own wife and child at home. It's mostly sort of this dark humor, Hitchcockian suspense sort of movie. The underlying theme that he's trying to put in the movie is that money will drive people to do horrible things. But it's also an enormous middle finger to every single one of his critics. He had been criticized for all his public affairs, so he plays this guy who, you know, there's an element clearly of misogyny in this character, and criticized for his left politics and for, you know, for the end speech in The Great Dictator. The end speech in Monsieur Verdoux is, and it kind of, if you watch the movie, it's kind of, you kind of hold it to the end. You know, I watched this movie and I heard it was sort of radical. It really is the last, you know, 10 minutes or so that it just sort of throws it at you. Then you can kind of read back and what's going on in the movie. But even a harsher, more just bitter, angry speech. And so I'm gonna show that here.
Harsh and angry.
Please, this is at the end of his trial.
Monsieur Verdoux, you have been found guilty. Have you anything to say before sentence is passed upon you?
Oui, monsieur, I have. However remiss the prosecutor has been in complimenting me, he at least admits that I have brains. Thank you, monsieur, I have. And for 35 years, I used them honestly. After that, nobody wanted them. So I was forced to go into business for myself. As for being a mass killer, does not the world encourage it? Is it not building weapons of destruction for the sole purpose of mass killing? Has it not blown unsuspecting women and little children to pieces and done it very scientifically? As a mass killer, I'm an amateur by comparison. However, I do not wish to lose my temper because very shortly I shall lose my head. Nevertheless, upon leaving this spark of earthly existence, I have this to say. I shall see you all very soon. Very soon.
Let's see, where are we? Now, as you can imagine, at the 1947, at the birth of McCarthyism, this was hugely, hugely unpopular. There was a campaign to stop the movie led by the American Legion, among other right-wing forces. Ohio theaters were encouraged by them to not show the movie because, not just this, but Chaplin had never become a citizen. He'd always maintained his British citizenship. The Memphis Censorship Board banned it, and it was a box office flop and a critical failure. But even after the movie just sort of disappeared, the attacks on him did not disappear. A New Jersey television station in 1953 had planned to show a series of Chaplin's old silent movies, and they were picketed by the Catholic War veterans, and they ended up canceling all of them. Now, while the state was quite willing to go after him and couldn't really see being effective on their own right, they enlisted. You know, you think of Hollywood as being liberal, and there was a much stronger and active left at this time, but there was a very right-wing sort of group of people around Hollywood, specifically the gossip columnists, and they hated Chaplin, and they were extremely right-wing and anti-communist. Hedda Hopper was one of the two most leading gossip columnists at the time. She said at the time, quote, Chaplin should keep constantly in mind that he is not a citizen, merely a guest, and should conduct himself as a guest. Up to this point of exposure, he had a right to become a citizen, but I doubt that he could now become one. I'm sure the laws of our country include moral turpitude as good and sufficient grounds for the deportation of an alien. Ed Sullivan. People know the Ed Sullivan Show, the Beatles, and Elvis. Before he had the show, he was one of these Hollywood gossip columnist right-wing lunatics. And he also hated Chaplin. And he said at the time, during the war, instead of entertaining the troops or our wounded, Chaplin delivered nothing but political speeches for Russia demanding a second front. Later, Chaplin was in the middle of a attorney suit, and Sullivan claimed the Soviets had a plane ready. Total bullshit. But he said somebody had a plane ready just in case he lost his suit. He was going to get on the plane, fly to Russia. He'd been learning to read Russian, and just total nonsense, just spreading slander against Chaplin. And now Sullivan, Hopper, and the other leading gossip colonists, Luella Parsons, they all actually cooperated with the FBI in their campaign against, you know, many people, but against Chaplin in particular. The FBI fed them stories to put in their columns, whereas the columnists who were sort of worked in the Hollywood, you know, social milieu could report back to the FBI about who was doing what and who was going doing what activities. The FBI investigation itself produced a huge file against Chaplin, thousands of pages. It claimed there's all sorts of nonsense. It claimed that he was defended from the quote Thonstein family and spoke with a Jewish accent, which is just nonsense. It's not true at all. There's all sorts of secondhand rumors. Some FBI agent talked to somebody who had talked to somebody who said the Chaplin was here or there, and that ends up in the file. You know, then they go and investigate it, and just the people who, you know, said, oh yeah, never. Even the people who made the original claim just never supported them. But this is just filled his file just in case they wanted to go after him. Now, after this, you know, it's not clear if he was burned or demoralized or more likely just isolated because the entire Hollywood left was either blacklisted or co-opted. Chaplin really took a step back and was much quieter about his political attitudes. His final film in the United States was Limelight, which is a great film, but it's completely apolitical. It's really about Chaplin plays an aging stage comedian who defends a young dancer, and it's about him growing old and losing his ability as a comedian and losing his audience. It's a really touching and great film. In some ways, it feels like him compensating for, you know, some of his what he thought were missteps and trying to kind of reconcile with his audience. I'm going to show a quick clip here. This is Chaplin playing Calvero, the stage comedian, doing this sort of flea circus routine, you know, vaudevillian flea circus routine.
Yes, you want me to scratch? That's not Phyllis. Where's Phyllis? Oh, there she is.
Now that gives you a hint of the kind of movie Limelight was. Now the fact that he had sort of quieted his politics and made this much more sort of heartfelt film, much less political film, really did absolutely nothing to stop the campaign against him. A boycott campaign grew against Limelight immediately. The American Legion passed a series of resolutions to ban the film. Lowe's, which is one of the theater distributors, declined to carry the movie. RKO, and another big Hollywood studio, they picked it up, but Howard Hughes was one of the chief stockholders, and he wrote to the Hollywood Legion and promised them that he would do everything that he could to cancel all the bookings of the movie. I'm just about to wrap it up. The Legion protests were much more successful. They canceled film showings in Philadelphia, New York City, Columbus, Ohio, and New Orleans. And one journalist said in February 1953 that a typical Chaplin film, having been open for that period of time, would have played to 2,300 theaters, but Limelight had only played to 150 by that time because of the boycott campaign. Chaplin went on a tour of Europe to tour the film, but not the FBI, not McCarthy, not HUAC, but the Truman administration, the Attorney General, revoked his reentrance visa. Basically, that was the only way they could get him, and they needed to get him because he was one of the very few people who stood up and spoke out and refused to shut up about McCarthyism, and they had to make a statement that either you join our side or you're going to face the consequences, and that was the one way they got to face the consequences. And so this incredible thing that the great star, movie star of American films of the first half of the 20th century, basically, kicked out by the government and really abandoned. And he would only return one time 20 years later to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy when the political atmosphere had altered significantly. I think Chaplin, like I said, he was a very contradictory figure. He was an outspoken radical against the winds of McCarthyism, but he's also a Stalinist, a womanizer, a studio owner, a producer, and he sometimes, even though he was a radical, sometimes he sort of timidly hid behind being an artist and not a politician. But his legacy is important, and because he was a fighter, and he was a fighter when a lot of people fought back in the 30s, and he was a fighter when a lot of people were really afraid to fight back in the 1940s, and that's important to remember. Politically, his legacy is, it should be defended, it's important, but also needs to be criticized, because it's there's problems with it. Artistically, I think his legacy is overwhelmingly brilliant. He has a body of work that's, the number of hours of film made. I mean, it's really a really great film that's both popular and really heartfelt, and it's really continued to inspire people for years. And I think his legacy artistically is pretty unquestionably brilliant. It should be whatever criticism you might make of his politics, his political films really should be seen and appreciated as apolitical films as well for years to come.